from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Madeline Miller, whose new book is Circe, published by Little Brown, or Kierke, as I learned during the interview, which you'll hear. Madeline Miller was born in Boston and grew up in New York and Philadelphia. She attended Brown, where she earned her BA and MA in classics. She has taught and tutored Latin, Greek, and Shakespeare to high school students for more than 15 years. She has also studied at the University of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought and in the dramaturgy department at Yale School of Drama, where she focused on the adaptation of classical texts to modern forms. The Song of Achilles, her first novel, was awarded the 2012 Orange Prize for Fiction and was a New York Times bestseller. It has been translated into over 25 languages, including Dutch, Mandarin, Japanese, Turkish, Arabic, and Greek. Madeline was also shortlisted for the 2012 Stonewall Writer of the Year, and her essays have appeared in a number of publications, including The Guardian, Wall Street Journal, Latham's Quarterly, and NPR.org. Her second novel, Circe, was an instant number one New York Times bestseller. She currently lives outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Here's a little information about Circe. In the house of Helios, god of the sun and mightiest of the Titans, a daughter is born. But Circe is a strange child, not powerful like her father, nor viciously alluring like her mother. Turning to the world of mortals for companionship, she discovers that she does possess power, the power of witchcraft, which can transform rivals into monsters and menace the gods themselves. Threatened, Zeus banishes her to a deserted island, where she hones her occult craft, tames wild beasts, and crosses paths with many of the most famous figures in all of mythology, including the Minotaur, Daedalus, and his doomed son Icarus, the murderous Medea, and, of course, wily Odysseus. But there's danger, too, for a woman who stands alone, and Circe unwittingly draws the wrath of both men and gods, ultimately finding herself pitted against one of the most terrifying and vengeful of the Olympians. To protect what she loves most, Circe must summon all her strength and choose once and for all whether she belongs with the gods she is born from or the mortals she has come to love. With unforgettably vivid characters, mesmerizing language, and page-turning suspense, Circe is a triumph of storytelling, an intoxicating epic of family rivalry, palace intrigue, love and loss, as well as a celebration of indomitable female strength in a man's world. When I spoke with Madeline Miller this morning, I began by asking her to talk about her introduction to the classics. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I came to the classics because my mom used to read me bits of the Iliad and the Odyssey when I was a child. And now she is afraid that that makes her sound really inappropriate. But I love them. And I actually have a memory of her saying sort of the first line of the Iliad to me, or at least I have a memory of my emotional reaction to it, which was, "Sing, goddess of the destructive rage of Achilles." And this was unlike anything else I had heard, anything else I had been read. And I was just completely hooked. You know, what was this? Why was Achilles so angry? What was this rage? It sounded so epic. And I continued to love these stories for a very long time, and just to read every version of them I could. And I was fortunate that when I got to high school, I had a wonderful Latin teacher who taught me ancient Greek. And that was just a whole other revelation, getting to read Homer in the original poetry. It was completely electrifying. And so I, you know, went right off into college and masters. And, you know, this was what I wanted to study. But it was, for me, it was always rooted in the poetry and in the mythology. Mm-hmm. That was really my focus, because I thought that the stories were they were exciting, but they were also so beautiful, not just in terms of the way they were told, but in their insights into human nature.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your maybe first reactions to, or just a general sense of your feelings about Circe, and maybe, you know, why you were drawn to this particular character in the myth.
Yes. So my first interaction with Circe, I was 13 years old, and I was reading my own copy of the Odyssey. And I was really excited about this. I could not have been more thrilled. I felt like a real scholar. You know, I was highlighting and underlining and very excited. And we came to the section where Odysseus lands on the island of Aeaea, which is Circe's island. Now, at this point in the story, he's exhausted. His men are exhausted. He's lost all of his ships except for one. He's watched his men torn apart by the Cyclops and, you know, devoured by Cannae. I mean, it's been horror after horror, horror after horror. So that's the man who arrives on Aeaea. And they see it's a beautiful, lush island, and they see some smoke drifting. And so he sends some men up to her house. And outside the house, there are these lions and wolves that are tame, lolling around the garden, which doesn't seem to make them suspicious. They go right into the house. They go right up to the house. One of the men is suspicious, I should say. But the rest just go right in. And they're welcomed by this beautiful goddess who offers them food. And she offers them wine, which she has drugged. And after they consume it, she uses her magical powers to turn them into pigs. Now, the one man who didn't go in, he goes running back. He tells Odysseus, and Odysseus has to, of course, come up and help. And Odysseus gets a little bit of a hand on his way up because Hermes comes down, the god Hermes, and says, you know, Circe's a very powerful witch. I'm going to give you some herbs that will make you immune to her spells. So Odysseus takes those and he goes in. And I can remember at this point in the story just feeling so excited because, you know, there are not very many female characters like Circe. Right. She's powerful, she's independent, she's smart, she has pet lions. I mean, it's hard to get that. And then you have Odysseus coming, and I thought, well, this is really going to be a great scene. You know, this is going to be the wily hero and this powerful sorceress, and we're going to have a real battle of wits. But what actually happens in the scene is that Circe tries to turn him into a pig, and it doesn't work because of his magical herbs from Hermes. And he pulls out his sword and threatens her. And she screams and drops to her knees and begs for mercy and invites him into her bed kind of all at once. And I was just
disappointed.
I was so disappointed and frustrated, and, you know, just felt like, wow, she literally has to be put in her place on her knees. And I just thought we couldn't just stay with her a little bit longer. And, you know, even then I understood that this was a quest narrative and, you know, the hero has to overcome the obstacle and she's the obstacle, so she has to be tamed and all that. But it just felt so like, that's it. I don't get any more Circe. And so I really think that was some of the initial impulse for the novel, although it, you know, it went deep underground for many, many years. Yeah. But I think it was just that impulse to say, you know, let's stick with her story for a minute, and let's imagine that she isn't tamed, and then instead we get to follow her, and see that encounter from her perspective. And the interesting thing about Homer is that as I continued to study Homer, and when I was approaching him more as like a graduate student and an undergrad, is that his portrait of Circe actually really invites that. It's more complex than what I saw as a 13-year-old, where all I saw was sort of the phallic symbol of the sword and the unfairness and the kneeling. And all that is definitely there. But after she and he become lovers, she retains a lot of her power. She ends up being this sort of benevolent patron goddess to him, and she gives him a lot of wisdom as to how to get by frightening monsters, and she counsels him on how to talk to the shades from the underworld. He has to go talk to the dead prophet Tiresias, and, you know, she, as a witch, she knows, you know, these are the dimensions of the pit you have to dig, these are the libations, this is what you have to do. And so Homer definitely gives her a lot of that knowledge, that really helpful kind of witchy, you know, dead and monsters knowledge, which was interesting. And it was also interesting to me that Odysseus, she says to him, you know, you're exhausted, stay on my island and heal. And he stays for a year, and at the end of the year, he doesn't want to go. His men have to kind of come and nudge him. So that was interesting to me too, that, you know, there's this piece of her that is very menacing and frightening, but then there's this piece of her that is powerful but benevolent and, you know, charismatic enough that Odysseus genuinely is a little bit disappointed to have to leave. So yeah. That was that sort of layered in as well.
It's interesting. I don't know the story as well as I should probably. I'm very curious to go back now and read it. But hearing you describe the original storyline of Circe and the way that she behaves in the true text, not what you read when you were 13, makes me think that her character really comes through in this book, because she does tend, she has power and she can be quite, you have to take her seriously if you're on the wrong side of her. On the other hand, if you're on the right side of her and if you treat her well, she is a very good friend to you. She really appreciates being respected and being given, you know, kindness. You know, she spends a lot of her young life, well, I don't know about young because she's immortal, but anyway, in the early part of the book, she's looking for that kindness.
Yes, and that was a piece of her that was just there from the beginning for me in my conception of her. Homer, among other things, gives us this fascinating detail about how Circe is the dread goddess, the terrifying goddess, who speaks like a human, like a mortal. And that was really fascinating to me because, again, it implied that dichotomy of sort of the frightening aspect, but also the very human aspect. And, you know, she's a figure who stands with a foot in both worlds. She can kind of communicate with humans. She can communicate with gods. And in a sense, she doesn't belong to either world fully. You know, she's a little bit of an outsider in both ways, but she can also comment on each of those worlds. And as I was exploring this novel, what I wanted to do was look at what it meant to be a god, a Greek god in particular, and what it meant to be mortal. And the Greek gods, they're really horrendous. They're terrible. You know, they're cruel and narcissistic, and they really only care about their own desires. You know, occasionally they have favorites that they might help out, but it's always sort of with an eye to their own honor, or something they want. And what I really saw as being a quality of humanity that the gods do not have is this sense of empathy, this ability, because humans suffer and try and fail. You know, we're not born perfect and, you know, get able to get anything we want just at a snap. We are able to understand the suffering of others as well. And so a lot of her journey is sort of resonates with that mortal sympathy.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the unattractive depiction of gods. They, you know, it's so interesting. They're vain, they're unkind, they're competitive, they're lazy. But, you know, it struck me that if we all knew, well, I mean, not all of the characters in this book are going to live forever, but if we all knew that it was very likely that we were going to be immortal, I don't know that we'd be our very best selves.
Right.
I'm wondering if you think that's part of what was behind that depiction.
Absolutely. I mean, I wanted to look at this novel sort of from the perspective of abuse of power. Now, Circe, as a woman, is someone who is often on the receiving end of that abuse, of this predatory culture. But she certainly is not the only one. You know, men, women, all mortals, anyone who doesn't have that kind of power. And the ancient Greek gods were very hierarchical. So if you were Zeus or you were Helios or, you know, Poseidon or Athena, you were at the very top of the feeding chain.
Right.
And life was good for you, and you could pretty much do what you wanted. Sometimes the fates would get in the way, but pretty much you could do what you wanted. And then all the way down at the very bottom of the chain, you have nymphs, which is what Circe is. And in the Greek myths, nymphs are pawns or their prey. They're constantly being sexually assaulted, abused, passed around, forced to marry someone they don't want to marry. And so I wanted to approach this world of power from the perspective of someone who has no power in it. She is the very bottom of the bottom. Huh. And her witchcraft is sort of this power that she creates herself. She has to seize it back because otherwise she would just be totally, you know, without any say in her own destiny for her entire life.
Right, but it makes sense that she doesn't even know very much about her witchcraft because everybody else is so self-involved that nobody took the time to teach her or tell her about it. Or maybe they didn't, maybe they had lost track of the fact that she would have it. I don't know.
Right. Well, and in my conception of it, witchcraft comes from hard work, which the gods are, you know, allergic to. They don't
right.
really believe in hard work. And what's interesting is that if you actually look at psychological studies that have been done in about sort of humans now, it's that the more powerful you become, the less empathy you display. Unless you fight against it. So, you know, you can overcome that, But the natural sort of response of humans to gaining in power and wealth and prestige is to actually have less empathy. And that, I think, absolutely speaks to the exactly what you were saying about the gods, that you know, and in some ways, at first glance, it kind of seems counterintuitive. It seems like people who had the least would be the least generous and the most kind of focused on making sure that they themselves were okay, but that is not the case. People who have the least are often the most generous and most empathetic because they understand suffering, you know, really vividly and viscerally because they themselves are experiencing a lack. So that was in my mind too as I was writing The Gods, that they are sort of the ultimate example of that.
Yeah, and I would add to your point that the people who have the least also can afford kindness and generosity and recognize that you can get great satisfaction out of that too, whereas the people who have the most and have power and money and everything else, they think that's what should be making them happy. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. No, I think it's absolutely true. And you know, there are obviously wonderful philanthropists out there that who are very, I think, compassionate and do work against it. But that's certainly the psychological trend.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I love, and you mentioned this, that gods hate, you write, gods hate all toil. It is their nature. And then she talks about witchcraft as drudgery. And I loved that sort of unveils for us, you know, her character coming out, sort of early in the novel, and it unveils her strength and tenacity and this incredible, I don't know, I think it made me want to know more about her and put me on her side right there.
Yes, and I loved that as she is drawn to the mortal world, one of the things she notices about mortals is how hard they have to work for things. And she comes to find a real virtue in that. Witchcraft in the ancient world was all about herbs. It was sort of a knowledge of herbs and ability to manipulate herbs and plants and poisons and all that, and sort of add your will to them. And then, you know, you got magic out of it. And I wanted that to be really a piece of her character, is that she likes doing that. There's another detail that Homer gives us about her, where he has Odysseus speaking about her, and Odysseus describes her as having beautifully braided hair. And that was one of those pieces where I was really trying to kind of flip the lens. Mm. And so I thought, okay, so Odysseus is bragging to everybody about this goddess he slept with and how she's so beautiful and her hair is just amazingly dressed. But I was thinking, well, if you were a witch and you were constantly in the woods digging up herbs and, you know, cutting through brambles and trying to get the perfect little flower and gardening, of course you would braid your hair. That's much more, you know, practical. And so I sort of looked at it from that perspective and, you know, wanted to make her a very practical person and to really connect her with sort of the earth and not this, you know, this male vision of her as kind of the fantasy sex object.
Yeah. There was that scene actually where she learns to braid her hair. Just trying to see how long. I have a question about that. So when she does get she gets sent to a deserted island, and there's this wonderful scene where she first confronts the woods and whatever wildlife might be living near her new home, and she's frightened and she worries about it, and we know that she's frightened, and I think she spends a night before she actually starts to look around. But then you do this super interesting thing. You write, "I stepped into those woods and my life began." And so on the next page, where I'm expecting to see her walking through the woods for the first time, you write, "I learned to braid my hair back so it would not catch on every twig, and how to tie my skirts at the knee to keep the burrs off. I learned to recognize the different blooming vines and gaudy roses, to spot the shining dragonflies and coiling snakes." And it goes on from there. But I loved this because she enters the woods with such resolve. You don't need to show us her first walk. You can skip right into what she learns in the coming months. And I don't know if you remember making that decision. I thought it worked really well. I just wondered if you happened to, did you just write it that way, or did you try to write her first walk in the woods and decide you didn't need it?
That is a great question. I did not write her first walk in the woods. This was always kind of my imagination of it. And I think it's because with Circe, because she's a first person narrator and she is a goddess, so she lives for centuries, I wanted there to be moments of sort of time, jumping is the wrong word, but where you feel the time kind of speed up and slow down and speed up and slow down. And so I think that was one of those moments where, you know, for her, what she remembers is the visceralness of sort of being in the woods and loving the woods and what she's learning, as opposed to that first moment that, you know, she kind of goes to the continuous experience as opposed to the single experience, coming out of that goddess, you know, thousands of years aspect. So I think that was actually coming right out of my wanting to honor that immortal aspect in her voice.
Yes, that is so. I was going to ask you about that because I figured that in the original myth, probably there's a lot of sped up time. And here what you do is you choose moments to delve down into, which I'm sure they did too, but you do so even more within story. But then, you know, we still get, and I'm not talking just about moments like this moment in the woods, but we also get, like, there are characters that she meets who we're familiar with from the original mythology. So like Daedalus and Icarus and the Minotaur and lots and lots. But you still kind of, you respect your having introduced these characters by giving us their ultimate story. So we learn about what happens to Daedalus. We learn about Icarus flying too close to the sun, but you do that very quickly, and that this sort of like that's not the story you're telling. They were part of the story you're telling. So the whole way that you handled narrative time was so interesting to me, and I know you just sort of mentioned it, but can we talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, actually, that was something that took me quite a long time to work with, because none of the ancient sort of texts that talk about Circe really approach her from that first person perspective. And oftentimes they just show her a little bits. So that episode where, you know, Odysseus arrives on the island, stays for a year and then leaves, takes up, you know, 2+ books of the Odyssey, and that's it. And we don't see Circe again. The rest of it is all Odysseus's story. And so, for the first kind of 5 years out of the 7 it took me to write this, I was just trying to get that divine aspect to her voice. And it took me a long time to get Patroclus's voice too in the Song of Achilles, my first novel. Yes. So, but what I was doing was I was just writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, not even so much from like a fiddling with, you know, words here, words there, but more like just each time kind of trying a different approach. And it was a very intuitive process. I have a background in theater, and so part of what I was trying to do was literally hear her as if she was delivering, you know, her monologue to me. And it took a long time to kind of hear the right tone that I wanted, and have that be able to come organically. Because the one thing I really didn't want was to be injecting it in ways that felt, you know, I felt like I kind of had to get it all at once. Right. It was this big thing. I couldn't get it piece by piece. I had to get the whole thing, which is why I think it took me 5 years. And actually what ended up happening was that after 5 years, I still hadn't gotten it. I didn't have her voice, and I wasn't able to bring out some of those aspects of her that I wanted to, because I wanted a sense of timelessness and a real kind of expansiveness to the way she looked at the world. I wanted characters to, you know, come and go, at least the mortal ones. But I also wanted a real directness to her voice, because she's a very direct person. And so I wanted that as well. And after 5 years, I was totally in despair.
Oh, no.
And I basically said, I don't think I can do this. I guess I can't do it. So I decided to take a break, and I worked on The Tempest for a little while. I direct Shakespeare plays, and so I love working with Shakespeare. So I was kind of thinking about a possible novel way into the Tempest. And
oh yes, please.
Thank you. It's such an exciting play, and there's so many little corners to explore. But I think something about working on The Tempest and, you know, magic and witches and islands and all that is also in Tempest, helped me kind of untangle what the pieces of Circe's story were, and, you know, figure out the path. Because after working on that for about 6 months, I came back to the Circe manuscript one day and I thought, well, let me just look through it. I mean, it was literally 500 pages of junk. It was 500 pages of false start. That was the, oh that was the document. And I was reading through it and I was sort of like, well, that word is right. That word is right. This sentence is right. Okay. And I, you know, all of a sudden sat down and wrote my first chapter. And I think what I had really been searching for is the first sentence. I needed the first sentence as my anchor, because I actually already knew, I didn't know what the last sentence would be, but I knew where I wanted her journey to end. And so I think a lot of that time was not only searching for the voice, but searching for the beginning. Because then I sort of, if I have the beginning and I have the end, then I can shoot the arrow. You know, I can hit that mark and draw the character's arc. But if I don't know where the beginning is, then I can't. I have nowhere to aim from, so to speak. So, you know, it's hard to kind of describe the process of it, because it was a lot of listening. I felt like I was listening to a musical piece and listening for the wrong notes. And for a long time, it was only wrong notes.
Wow. And so at what point was that when you wrote your first chapter's first draft? Like, you had worked already for 5 years. So how long ago was that?
That was about 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years ago, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk about the character Scylla. Mm-hmm. She's the first one on whom Circe tries a curse and it works. And this sets up such a fantastic amount of suspense in the book. It was so great. You know, it's funny, my association with Circe, or my, you know, the way I would react when I first picked up this book was, I'm going to read about Odysseus, right? And we don't even see Odysseus until we're halfway through the novel, which is so cool because it's just fascinating. I was just like, I was riveted, and I didn't realize that a lot of the tension in the story would actually be around Scylla, which, of course, if I knew the story better, I might have already known that. But let's see. I wonder, before we talk about Scylla, maybe you could read the page that we talked about, and then we could talk a little bit about Scylla.
Sure. So in the mythology, just to set the scene,
yeah.
Scylla or Scylla, you can say it both ways. So if I slip and say Scylla, that's just
the... Oh, no. Just let me know how I should say it. I probably messed it up.
No, you did not. You said it the more anglicized way, but I learned it the more Greek way, which is with the hard K.
Oh, okay.
But I'm totally inconsistent because, of course, Circe was really Kirke. So so you can really do both ways. So she was the six-headed monster who lived on one side of a pair of strait, one side of the straits, and on the other side was Charybdis, who was this gigantic whirlpool monster. And ships, as they had to sail through, would always want to be on the Scylla side or Scylla side, because she would come down and she would take six of your men. But if you went on the whirlpool side, the whirlpool would take the whole ship. So, and then if you weren't fast enough, Scylla would come down and take another six. So you'd lose 12, but that's still better than the whole ship. So people often use the Scylla and Charybdis as being kind of like between a rock and a hard place, but it's a little bit more like out of the frying pan into the fire, I think. One of them is definitely worse. So in this section, Circe is going through the straits, and she knows that Scylla's gonna try and eat the men on the boat.
Okay, great.
The mist came first. It closed in wet and heavy, obscuring the cliffs, then the sky itself. We could see little, and the sound of the sucking whirlpool filled our ears. That whirlpool was, of course, the reason Scylla had chosen these straits. To avoid its pull, ships must steer close to the opposite cliff. It brought them right beneath her teeth. We pushed on through the thick air. As we entered the straits, the sound grew hollowed, echoing off the stone walls. My skin, the deck, the rail, every surface was slick with spray. The water foamed, and an oar scraped the rock face. A small sound, but the men flinched as if it were a thunderclap. Above us, buried in the fog, was the cave and Scylla. We moved, I thought we did, but in such grayness it was impossible to tell how far or fast. The oarsmen were trembling with effort and fear, and the oarlocks creaked despite their oil. I counted the moments. Surely we were beneath her now. She would be creeping to the cave's opening and smelling out the plumpest. The sweat was drenching the men's tunics, their shoulders hunched. Those not rowing crouched behind coils of rope, the mast base, any cover they could find. I strained my eyes upwards, and she came. She was gray as the air, as the cliff itself. I had always imagined she would look like something, a snake or an octopus, a shark. But the truth of her was overwhelming, an immensity that my mind fought to take in. Her necks were longer than ship masts. Her six heads gaped, hideously lumpen, like melted lava stone. Black tongues licked her sword-length teeth. Her eyes were fixed on the men, oblivious in their sweating fear. She crept closer, slipping over the rocks. A reptilian stench struck me, foul as squirming nests underground. Her necks wove a little in the air, and from one of her mouths I saw a gleaming strand of saliva stretch and fall. Her body was not visible. It was hidden back in the mist with her legs, those hideous boneless things that Selene had spoken of so long ago. Hermes had told me how they clung inside her cave like the curled ends of hermit crabs when she lowered herself to feed.
Thank you. That scene is so amazing. And I'm making you stop there because I don't want to give anything away. And I already feel like asking you to read that has given away what she looks like, which is kind of suspenseful in itself. But thank you so much. That's so fantastic. So okay, let's talk about Scylla or Scylla. How much is she described in the original myth, and how much did you create her?
She is described, so there's sort of Homer's description of her, but there were multiple interpretations of her over the years and a real embroidering of her mythology. So I follow the Homer description, which is she has these six necks and these six heads, and you know, each head takes a whole man, so she's pretty big. And she has these 12 dangling legs, which seem like they're kind of tentacle-esque. Mm-hmm. And she barks. Like, that's what Homer says. She sounds like sort of like, you know, baying, shrieking, the worst kind of sound that dogs can make, that sound. So it's a very bizarre sound. But in later versions, oftentimes if you Google images of ancient Greek, you know, vase paintings, Scylla, you'll get this picture of a woman who has dogs kind of bursting out of her middle with sometimes tentacles below. So people really went nuts with their visualization of her. They love to imagine her and to do her all different ways. So, but Homer is, I sort of stayed with the Homeric version. Her story, as it connects to Circe's story, it actually appears in Ovid. So as people sort of retold stories about her and retold them, they imagined that she was originally a nymph who had been transformed. So she got this whole kind of backstory. And the Ovid story, there's a love triangle between, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but it is, you know, 2,000 years old. There's a love triangle between Circe and Glaucus, who's a human who becomes a god, and Scylla. And in Ovid, Circe is a really pathetic figure. And Ovid likes to write about Circe because his famous work is the Metamorphoses, the transformations, and she's the goddess who transforms people. So, you know, she makes a really good subject for him in a couple instances. But he makes her so lovelorn. She's always falling in love with the wrong guy. It's always like he's just not that into you, Circe. And then she gets angry, lashes out. And it's this very stereotyped kind of irrational woman scorned behavior. And because what Ovid is really interested in is he likes to describe her power. He's not really interested in her three-dimensional psychology. Yeah. So in the original love triangle, she falls in love with Glaucus when he comes to her to ask for a love potion to make Scylla love him. Scylla is at that point still a beautiful nymph. And Circe immediately falls in love with him and says, forget her. And I just thought, well, that is really shallow and uninteresting. And I wanted to push back against Ovid because I think throughout Greek mythology, women are often portrayed that way. You know, why is Circe turning men to pigs? Homer never tells us. It's just because she's, you know, she's capricious. She's an irrational woman. I feel like that sort of is a lot of the answers for why female characters do things, or they're either that or they're insulted in love, and so they, you know, get angry. And I wanted to make her, I wanted to make her make the same horrendous mistake that she makes in Ovid, which is transforming Scylla the nymph into the monster, but for at least a little bit of a better reason. And I wanted to focus on, not a better reason, but a more understandable reason, a more psychologically complex reason.
Yeah, fuller reason, yeah.
Yes. And I wanted to focus more on the consequences of that. You know, now she has to live with that mistake forever. Because right. God, if you make a mistake, it's forever. And so that's what I was looking at. And again, you know, kind of reconfiguring the triangle so that I'm returning, hopefully, a little bit of three-dimensionality to the character. I wanted to give some of that to Scylla as well, that, you know, I wanted there to be a touch of, I mean, Scylla is like many gods, a terrible person, and, you know, very, very vain and self-involved, and
cruel. She's a mean girl. She's a total mean girl.
She is. But I think as Cersei grows up, she comes to understand that, you know, some of that behavior is Scylla's a nymph like her. She has no power in this world, and so she was horrible, but, you know, she was using her sexuality and her power and her ability to kind of dominate others socially as a way to get a leg up in this world that, you know, would discard her otherwise. And so I think Cersei comes to have a more nuanced understanding of why particularly a woman might behave that way.
Yeah. If we back up a little bit from the part that you read, I'm just going to read a few sentences, if you don't mind. There's this point where she doesn't yet know what has happened. I mean, she knows that Scylla has been transformed, but she doesn't know very much about what's happened to her, where she is. And this is after Cersei is exiled, and she's and you write, "I thought of Scylla then. Did her nymph self live still inside that six-headed monster, or did plants grown from the blood of gods make the change a true one? I did not know. Into the air I said, 'Wherever you are, I hope you are finding your satisfaction.' Which, of course, now I know she was." That was so excellent. That word "now" brings us into a storytelling time. And we know that the narrative time that we've just been reading, she's not fully informed yet. It was so good. So actually, and that reminded me a little bit of like the moment of walking into the woods. You know, I walked into the woods and my life changed. You're really good at these moments that build suspense. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about building suspense.
In terms of suspense, that was a really important component for me, for two reasons. One was the fact that I did really want this to be an adventure and an epic story, just like the Odyssey and the Iliad. Part of my project with this was to take a female character and to put her story at the center of an epic, and to kind of tell her whole life and, you know, make it that big adventure story. And I think women's lives have traditionally not been allowed to be epic. They've been considered not interesting enough. You know, it's always men who are at the center of epic, whether we're talking about Gilgamesh, the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, the Mahabharata, like there are female characters, but epic is about men because it's about big things, which are traditionally male, like war and destiny. And, you know, all these things that are associated with the male hero, whether or not they should be. And so I wanted that sense of adventure story, but I also wanted there to be a sense of suspense because Cersei is telling this story from, you know, much later in life, but she still doesn't really know as she is speaking it what exactly is going to happen to her. So I think she feels a sense of suspense, of being literally held poised to find out what, you know, how her story is going to unfold. Is she just going to be this god who lives forever alone on her island? Or, you know, will there be more? Is there more coming for her? And so that was a piece of it. In terms of building suspense, one of the things that I had to look at with this book is I wanted this book to have a touch of episodicness because it was inspired by the Odyssey. And the Odyssey, of course, is the great episodic story.
Right.
You know, Odysseus goes to Aia and he goes to the Cyclops and he's always kind of, you know, he has all these stops along the way and things happen to him. And, you know, it's always a new adventure, a new obstacle to overcome. And you can really break it down into sections. And so I wanted to have a little bit of that episodic nature, but I also had to kind of thread that through with an overall character arc. In terms of actually crafting that in the writing, it's hard to sort of think about how that happened other than just wanting to be aware of both that sense of adventure and that sense of the larger arc, and have moments where the older Circe kind of breaks into the story and then steps back out and breaks in. And, you know, I tried to have that be really important or climactic, you know, emotional moments.
Yeah. Yeah, they totally are. They really work. Now, you mentioned the episodes that you include in the book, the episodes that come from the originals. Were there any that you started to include and then decided it just doesn't fit with the story I'm writing and you had to take something out that maybe you wished you could have left in, but you just couldn't?
Oh, that's a great question. There weren't any that I really wished I could keep in. So the mythology gives us the Scylla episode that comes from Ovid. There's another episode where she meets up with Medea, who is her niece, by the way.
Right.
And you know, that comes right out of the mythology. That meeting where Medea and Jason come to her island is out of Apollonius of Rhodes' Argonautica. And I get to write the conversation between the two great witches of ancient Greek mythology. But that meeting was in the mythology. So I knew, that was a must include for me. Because speaking about powerful, interesting, complex women, Medea is just so interesting. And it's interesting that the two are related and they both have their witchcraft. And then it was more, let's see, there was one piece towards the ending. And again, I'm going to be very vague here.
That's fine.
Where in terms of the ending, I was following a lost epic called the Telegony. So the Iliad and the Odyssey are the most well-known epics because they're the ones who have survived. But there were other ancient epics during that time, and one of them was called the Telegony, and it was about a son named Telegonus that Circe has with Odysseus. And in that story, again, kind of a spoiler, but Penelope, Odysseus's brilliant wife,
making her tapestry back at home.
Yeah, exactly. And Telemachus meet Circe. And so that is in the ancient myth. So that was very exciting. I mean, when you know Penelope is waiting for you, and talk about, you know, again, two very interesting, complex women getting to talk to each other finally. But the Telegony ends in kind of a bow. It ends up with this very neat, almost, you know, fairy tale ending.
Okay.
Not like Greek myths normally end. Greek myths end in blood, and then she got turned into a bird. But it ends in a surprise, in a weirdly happy but sort of unsatisfying way.
Okay.
An unsatisfying happy ending.
Right.
And I felt that it was too unrealistic, which I know sounds a little absurd given that I literally just read a passage about a six-headed monster, but it felt unrealistic to me. And so I changed the configuration. Again, I kind of shifted the configuration of the ending so that it wasn't in that neat little, you know, box it was in. And it is still, I think, moving towards a happy ending, but in a more complicated and, I like to think, realistic way. So there were certainly things that I rejected. There's a myth where Circe turns this guy into a woodpecker. That was never going to make it. You know, I think we can leave that out. So I was definitely kind of picking and choosing and changing. And I felt, you know, with Song of Achilles, I had a lot of anxiety about that. I'm a classicist, and I was very worried that the classics police were going to come and be angry at me, and I was going to be kicked out of the classics club, and you know, professors weren't going to talk to me. And I had a lot of anxieties about that. And I think with Circe, I got over it partially because the classics community has largely been incredibly supportive and kind, and partially because I wanted Cersei to be pushing back against those stories that, you know, she is telling, she's saying, sure, okay, that's the male heroic tradition, but here's my version of what happened. And so it felt right for me to conflict at moments and to say, yeah, okay, you made up 10 more stories about me turning guys into something, but I'm just, you know, that's your version.
Right. Well, and it seems completely consistent that you should thrive when you stop worrying about what whether you're being accepted, because that's what happened to Cersei, right?
Exactly. That's true. I had not thought about that.
The other thing I would add to something you just said is you were saying it was funny to say that it wasn't realistic enough because of the six-headed monster. But I think when you use the word realism, you're talking about within the universe that you've created. It has to be honest to that truth. It has to be real within that world. Yes.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, and a lot of that is, I think, is very instinctual. It's just sort of you feeling out where are the boundaries and what violates those rules and what doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. This is a kind of trivial question, but I was curious. Did you study witchcraft and potions, or did you make it all up?
I studied ancient herbcraft. So I looked at a lot of manuscripts about healing and sort of medical manuscripts to see what kind of herbs were used, because medicine and witchcraft really overlapped in the ancient world and frankly well into the modern world too.
Okay.
You know, the backwoods witches were oftentimes, you know, healers who helped the village with kind of local herb lore until something bad happened and then the village would turn on them and, you know, kill them as a witch.
Right. Recently as Salem and probably.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So medicine and witchcraft, I think, have always gone hand in hand. So in terms of the individual potions, I made them up, but all the herbs are herbs that were used in the ancient world, not always the Greek world. I did expand it kind of into the larger ancient world a little bit. And I tried to, you know, honor many of those uses. So, you know, yarrow really was used as a clotting agent. Aconite and hellebore were poisons and, you know, still are. And so that kind of stuff. So I tried to be true to that. But the individual potions that she uses sort of to make transformations, I made up the combinations just based on what seemed right.
Okay. All right, great. Let's see. Madeline, what are you reading these days that you might recommend to listeners?
Oh, I just this morning started an Angela Carter book that I have never read, The Magic Toy Shop.
Okay.
Which is great. I mean, the first 25 pages just totally sucked me right in. And I thought I was confused because she often writes short stories. So I thought it was a short story. And I, at some point I was like, wow, what's happening? And I kept, you know, so I flipped ahead. I was like, oh, it's the whole thing. But then I could really settle down and enjoy it. It's just, she's brilliant. She's so sharp and precise.
That's great.
I was in the UK, and the Virago, the wonderful press that focuses on female writers, just has published these beautiful new editions of kind of modern classics by women writers. And one of them was Heartburn by Nora Ephron, which is one of my all-time favorite.
Yeah. That's great.
It's so funny. I mean, she's always funny.
She's so funny.
Really on point. But what I love about Heartburn, it's her, you know, novelization of
her divorce,
yeah, from Carl Bernstein and the dissolution of their marriage, which happened in a pretty horrendous and heartbreaking way. And so I love the poignancy that's in it. It's a very sad and bitter story, but it doesn't come out as bitter. So it just the combination of the melancholy and the sadness with her unbelievable sense of humor is just, it's a really unbeatable combination. So I got a new edition of it that has a beautiful cover, and now I'm rereading it.
Yeah, that's great. Perfect. Those are great suggestions. And what are you working on now? Are you attempting The Tempest, or did you decide to do something else?
The Tempest is in there. It's definitely bubbling. I am thinking about also Virgil's Aeneid, which is the other great ancient love of my life. Mm. It's Virgil's epic poem about sort of the founding of Rome, and it comes from the perspective of the Trojans. So Aeneas, of, you know, the title, the Aeneid,
right.
Trojan refugee who, after the Greeks destroy and burn the city of Troy, he leads, you know, a very small band of people looking for a new home. And eventually they end up in Italy and intermarry with the local Italians and become, you know, they all become the Romans. So it was the Romans loved to make that their founding myth because they always wanted to tie themselves to the really cool Greek story. But it's a really beautiful story about losing your home. I mean, the first part is about losing your home, and then it sort of becomes very trenchant about power and abuse of power as Aeneas moves from being a refugee to now being an invader in Italy. So it's endlessly interesting. And Virgil is always interested in the cost. You know, what is the cost of the Roman Empire? You know, what did we have to lose? Who had to get stepped on? Who had to die in order for us to come to power? And I think that I love that perspective.
That sounds wonderful. That sounds great. Maybe I'll have to read that before I read your next book so I have so much more insight. Well, that actually leads really nicely into my last question for you. I like to end the interview with a question that has to do with advice for writers. And so I'm wondering if you have advice for people who are drawn to the idea of working from a classic or ancient work, or, you know, a previous work that maybe isn't that ancient, but re-examining something for a contemporary work. Do you have any advice for either finding it or, once it's found, for being ready to tackle it as they set out?
Yes. So for me, it always has to come from the character first. This is an incredibly obvious thing. I think it has to be a story you're obsessed with, that you feel compelled to tell. So for me, at least, it always has to start there. It has to come from the compulsion. You know, with both Patroclus and Circe, I never sat down and was like, which ancient Greek character should I write about? These were the characters that just gripped me and wouldn't let go. I would say that I think the most important thing is that it doesn't really matter how faithful you are to the text. I think that retellings can succeed very, very far from the text or very, very close to the text and anywhere along that spectrum. So, you know, people often talk about how faithful a text is or, you know, a retelling is. I don't really think it matters where you situate yourself along that spectrum. I think what matters is that you have a strong vision and you stay true to that vision. Because I think, you know, sometimes people feel that it's better if you stay closer. I don't necessarily think that's true. The Lost Books of the Odyssey by Zachary Mason, he has some really out there stories riffing on the Odyssey. There's one where Penelope is a werewolf and, you know, he just goes for it. And I think turns up some really interesting things in sort of doing that. He imagines the Iliad as a chess game, as like the record of a chess game, just very kind of unusual approaches to the text. And I think that's great. And I think can really work. So I would also recommend reading. There are two wonderful, there's so many wonderful literary adaptations. I mean, Wide Sargasso Sea, definitely read that.
Right.
That is such a wonderful, that's the retelling of Jane Eyre from the perspective of the mad woman in the attic.
Right.
And I would also really recommend John Updike's Gertrude and Claudius. That I read that about halfway through writing Song of Achilles. And what Gertrude and Claudius is about, it comes from the perspective that Hamlet ends up, everything that bad that happens in Hamlet, all the people who die, all the dead bodies, you know, all the horrors, all happen because Hamlet is a pill. And basically, his self-indulgence, his rigidity, his constant obsessing and overanalyzing, and his jealousy of his mother and his father issues all create this horrible series of events. And so it really blames everything on Hamlet. And it's told from the perspective of Gertrude, his mother, and Claudius, his stepfather, who kills his father. Really, it's as if John Updike sets out to prove that point, but a novel. And he totally nails it. By the end of it, I was like, God, Hamlet is the worst. And so I think that coming from that strong perspective of like, this is what I want to show, this is the story I want to tell, and I'm going to relentlessly prove it, but in a really exciting and interesting narrative way, is great. So have, as I said, I think that speaks to the have the strong vision, and that's a great model for that. I also think March is a wonderful by Geraldine Brooks, which is her, it's what's happening to Mr. March while, you know, we're reading Little Women. This is what he's doing off in the Civil War.
Yes, right.
Which is, again, a fascinating retelling and I think required reading for anyone doing an adaptation.
Okay, great. And then I have one to add, and I'm curious if you read The Red Tent by Anita Diamond. That's another one that I loved.
Absolutely. And Geraldine Brooks, The Secret Cord also.
Right. Yeah.
So I think both of those, that would make a great pairing with The Red Tent.
Yeah, that's true. And the Red Tent, I just know that the story of Dinah in the Bible is like, I don't know if it's even two paragraphs. So, I mean, that's another one where she just really took something small and expanded it out. So I want to just mention again that the name of the book is Circe, or Kirke, depending. and it's by Madeline Miller, and it's published by Little Brown. And I want to thank you, Madeline, so much for speaking with me today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Madeline Miller. We discussed her new book, Circe, published by Little Brown. More information about her work can be found on her website, madelinemiller.com. So this week's Write the Book prompt was offered by my guest, Madeline Miller. It's inspired by an Ursula K. Le Guin exercise. Madeline has used this one in her classes. She says it's about the elephant in the room. Write a scene that is about a major trauma without actually mentioning the trauma. For example, have two characters talk about a death that has just happened, but neither of them actually mentions the death. This is the elephant in the room. It is never named, but the truth of it is there in the scene. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and also on Facebook for updates, and you can find the podcast at my own website as well, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. It's how the word gets out about Write the Book. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.